Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. That our country leads the world in locking up people is not new. What has changed is location from urban to rural. It's Ray Geringer's focus in this latest report in her series on justice in eastern Kentucky.
Criminal justice reform advocates have noticed a shift in the geography of mass incarceration. Sparked by organizing over the past two decades, a pattern has developed of decarceration in major cities. But there's been a drastic increase in jail populations of rural counties across the nation. Jasmine Heiss works with the In Our Backyards initiative at the Vera Institute of Justice. The initiative includes data collection about incarceration trends in rural counties nationally, with the goal of using this research to inform public dialogue and drive policy change. She says that as major cities have reduced jail populations and populations have increased rurally, new dynamics have developed.
And so the accompanying dynamic around capacity, particularly in rural communities, is either that communities built these sort of oversized jails or continued to build to accommodate this growing jail population, and or that jails are overcrowded in those places because more and more people are being locked up on probation violations because they're too poor to pay money bail or being housed for other authorities. And I want to just underscore that it's not really like a sharp dynamic between places that are overcrowded because they haven't built bigger and places that have built bigger to accommodate overcrowding. What we see instead is, you know, what we continue to refer to as this sort of if you build it, they will come phenomenon, where even the places who have said, okay, the only way for us to sort of accommodate this increased criminalization and incarceration of people in our community is to build bigger, that those jails are often very quickly filled shortly after they're built. And so it becomes what my colleague Jack Norton calls this inter-county carceral arms race, where counties are just building bigger and bigger, and sometimes then looking towards their jails also as a source of revenue to offset the growing costs of all of this incarceration and construction and just planning for more and more people to be behind bars.
Heiss says that Kentucky stands out from the national landscape in that, even amidst an era of criminal justice reform where many states are reducing prison populations, jail incarceration in Kentucky continues to rise, especially in rural communities. John Cheeves is an investigative reporter at the Lexington Herald Leader, who covers state government at the Capitol in Frankfort, as well as a variety of issues statewide. In 2019, Cheeves published a four-part series called Caged, which looked into the issue of overcrowding in Kentucky jails.
A couple years ago, in 2019, we got a call from a woman who had a loved one in the Madison County jail down in Richmond, and she was talking about the conditions there being terrible. It was badly overcrowded. It was dangerous. And we started pulling on this thread. I wanted to look at how badly overcrowded some of the county jails were, but I wanted to do a new wrinkle, too, which was, what was the state's role in this? And it was pretty big, sort of in two areas. One was the state is largely to blame for the overcrowding. It wasn't just that local people are being held in local jails, but roughly half the people sitting in local jails, packing those cells, are actually state prisoners. They're people who are serving state time for felony crimes, who really should be in a state prison somewhere, but we love locking people up so much in Kentucky that there's not enough room in the prisons. At the time, we had a dozen, 12 state prisons, so we had about 9, 10,000, 11,000 and growing state prisoners sitting in county jails. So that was one way the state was contributing to this problem at the local jails. The other was that the state really should have been regulating these places better. There is a division of local facilities at the State Department of Corrections, and its job is to go around and inspect the local jails, make sure the conditions are decent, safe. And instead, it goes around and it just sort of takes notes on how bad the conditions really are, and it makes a checklist of it and files it away. The only thing it ever really closes a jail for is if there's unsafe fire conditions. But I've never seen a jail close because it was overcrowded. I've never seen a jail close because the inmates were brutally physically mistreated, even in places like Boyd County where the U.S. Justice Department stepped in. So a lot of people picture a jail as being what they see on TV, this hallway with the barred cells and one or two people in each cell. Well, what you're picturing is a prison there. And what jails actually are these large dormitories or pods, about 300 square feet behind a steel door. And inside this large dorm, there can be 20, 25, 30 guys all packed into a space that's really only big enough for half that many people. And they spend 23 hours a day in there. They sleep, they eat, they go to the bathroom, they shower. They're in there for days, weeks, months for the state prisoners that are serving felony time in there, sometimes for years in this room. And many of them don't even get a bed. They get, if they're lucky, what they call a boat, a plastic piece of bedding on the ground. I saw guys just sleeping on the ground on blankets and sheets because they didn't even have a mat or a boat to sleep on, sometimes in puddles. Practically cheek by jowl sitting next to each other. I saw guys who were sleeping in the detox tank on the concrete floor. I saw guys sleeping in hallways under picnic tables in the rec areas because the normal dormitories were so overcrowded.
Chief says that since the series was published in 2019, there have been some changes across the state. He says the legislature spent the next year holding a series of meetings about jail reform, one result of which was that the state of Kentucky reopened two private prisons to address the issue of jail overcrowding.
And this is considered important. Jail and prison is not the same thing. Prison is a large box, and it holds people for a long period of time, and it has rehabilitation programs, and it has room to move around. A jail is a small box, and it's often in the county seat near the courthouse. And its whole purpose is basically to hold you for a very short period of time, usually while you're awaiting trial or while you're serving a very short sentence. And there's not much room to move around inside a jail. And it was never designed to hold somebody for 1, 2, 3 years serving a felony sentence. And it doesn't have very much, if any, in the way of rehabilitative programming.
Cheeves also says that Senate Judiciary Chairman Whitney Westerfield is spending a lot of time looking at jails and how they can be reformed, including limiting the amount of profit that companies can make off of phone calls between incarcerated people and their families. And Cheeves says that the COVID-19 pandemic and Governor Andy Beshear's early release of over 1,800 incarcerated people because of it helped reduce jail populations across the state. But as the pandemic continues, those jail population numbers are beginning to rise again across Kentucky. And according to the Vera Institute of Justice, Kentucky is among the top 10 states for the highest incarceration rates in the country. And Cheeves doesn't think that the issue of rampant overcrowding in Kentucky jails will be resolved without change at the state level.
I don't feel like there's any unifying oversight to Kentucky jails. You know, we have elected jailers. Not every county has its own jail, as you know, but I think everyone has an elected jailer. And there's not any one entity that can step in and say, hey, you're doing a really poor job. This place is in deplorable physical shape. You're not treating the inmates well. I mean, in Boyd County, where the Justice Department Civil Rights Division came in and said, my God, you're torturing the inmates. I mean, you're spraying pepper spray on their genitals. You're humiliating them. You're physically abusing them. One guy that we had a video of in my story died after he was so thoroughly attacked. Came in on a minor, you know, alcohol or drug violation, whatever it was. At that time, the state continued to have scores of state prisoners held in this facility, even when the U.S. Justice Department was saying this is an unsafe place. So I feel like nobody in Frankfort seriously minds the store when it comes to local jails, and it has to be somebody in Frankfort. There needs to be a larger entity with statutory authority to come in, which the state actually has, but to seriously come in and inspect these places and say, you're doing this wrong, we're going to shut you down, we're going to fine you, we're going to fine the county, the fiscal court.
Organizers say that measures to decrease jail incarceration overall include bail reform, sentencing reforms, and increased access to rehabilitation and reentry services. For WEKU, I'm Ray Geringer.
This series on justice in Eastern Kentucky is being provided to Eastern Standard by Ray Geringer and Amelia Kirby with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and a grant from the Vera Institute of Justice. As Kevin Nance writes in a review on undermain.art, reading Tina Parker's eerie, shudder-inducing poetry collection Lock Her Up is a bit like walking into a haunted house, not of the kitschy Halloween variety, but a real-life chamber of horrors. They had a conversation about that.
Tina, thank you for being with us on Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to join you all for this conversation.
So your book is called Lock Her Up, and it's set at what was originally called Southwestern Lunatic Asylum, which today is known by a different name. I believe it's the Southwestern Mental Health Institute in Marion, Virginia. You grew up near there, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I grew up in Bristol, Virginia. So that was a very real place and kind of like, you know, you better stay in line or we'll send you up on the hill. Was the way we talked about it.
Did you hear stories about what went on in the hospital when you were growing up?
No, I only had like the vague threat of being sent there myself. Aside from that, no, I did not.
And you didn't ever know anyone who received treatment there?
No, I didn't.
So it was just this mysterious place.
Yes, it's kind of like, you know, as a child, I think it's one of the things that got me interested in hauntings. And, you know, it was just like this mysterious place on the hill.
Right. Well, how did you come back to it as a subject for this book? How did you come back around to this subject matter?
Well, it's interesting. It came back as I was thinking about the questions, who is sane and who decides, right? So a lot of projects start with the question. And with those in mind, I began a really deep dive into the history of women's health, mental health in our country, which is, had a lot of experimental practices around it, and especially mental health. It's not, you know, that long ago when women were just committed to asylum for any difference. And so it kind of came from asking those questions and being in a transition, you know, becoming a mother definitely brought me to a place where I had a whole different, you know, all these pressures culturally to be a certain way. It just got me thinking about transitions in women's lives and how, you know, is that perceived as a positive change or is it perceived as a fault or something that we want to kind of put away and keep silent?
The hospital has, I guess, a trove of patient records, admission forms, things of this kind, all sorts of documents. You went there and researched this whole topic, yes?
Yes, that's right. So I was, you know, as I got into my research, I realized in the state of Virginia, and at the Library of Virginia, I could go and look at these patient records that are so many years old by state law. And the Kentucky Foundation for Women gave me a grant to go and, you know, I had on the white gloves. I was in the archives looking at huge, like, books of patients' belongings, what they had with them when they arrived, forms that documented their appearance and, you know, the emotional, mental state when they arrived, and then even down to, like, daily logs of how they were doing each day, as well as, this was interesting, one-sided letters, correspondence that the superintendent wrote to the families back home, which were, of course, men in that time. It was men who made the decisions. It was actually a court process. So, you know, like a judge would come and decide if this person should be committed, and there would be witnesses. So that would be like the minister in the community, the doctor, the son, the husband, the father, who were making these decisions for women.
So in the book, you create really three main characters, three women who I take it are sort of composites of the women, the real life women that you read about in the records. Am I correct there?
Yes, you are, exactly. So I kind of made this composite based on, you know, the daughter committed by her father, the mother committed by her husband, and a widow committed by her son. I saw these patterns and kind of started thinking about what were their lives like in asylum, but also what were their lives like in their home. So in Appalachia, that's another, you know, passion of mine is my home place and looking into the culture and religion, the folklore, you know, and also the whole question, you know, is a woman a healer or a witch? That's something that's always, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with how we switch our labels around.
Tell us about these three women, just briefly, who they are. I know their names and just a little bit about their backgrounds.
Yeah, so I came up, the daughter is pretty young and fascinated me in the records, this notion of being committed by her father, and he is as a pay patient. So, like, he's actually paying for her to be there. And she had, it said she was just coming from school, and perhaps that's where her illness started. The other is a wife, a mother with young children, and she has several children and has recently lost one from drinking turpentine. So, you know, it's this thought of, you know, what does grief look like? Is that insanity? And who decides? And then the last is a widow. You know, a lot of women in the late 1800s, early 1900s could become widows very young. So this is a 55-year-old who supposedly, her son says, just sits in front of the mirror and deplores her condition. So there are these women in transition that I was really drawn to tell their stories.
The women that you've just described are the narrators or speakers in most of the poems. There are a couple of poems in the book. I was fascinated by this, and I talk about it in my review of your book in Under Main, which will be coming out in tandem with this interview on Eastern Standard. There's a couple of poems in the book in which the speakers are not people at all. They are, I suppose you might call them, inanimate objects. One of them is called Southwestern Lunatic Asylum. In other words, the hospital itself. Could you read that for us?
Yes, I will. Thank you. Southwestern Lunatic Asylum. Get me out, they cry day after day. Get me out of this place. They walk too heavy. Their voices swell my rooms. Disturbed, leprous, sick. They should know to tiptoe. They should know how to speak in whispers. My walls throb. I absorb wounds and hold them until darkness descends.
Well, that's a spooky sounding poem. And in fact, there is, you mentioned early on the idea of haunting. There is a kind of haunted house quality to this entire book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You know, I'm very fascinated with domestic horror, psychological thrillers, hauntings of Appalachia. You know, I kind of dove into every possible story I could get my hands on. And I think a lot of that comes with, you know, I grew up reading the Bible. Revelation was, I read it over and over, which, so, you know, a lot of people wouldn't pick that as their go-to. But the Southern Gothic is just woven its way into my writing.
Well, in addition to being, to some extent, a ghost story, this book is also, it struck me, and I also say this in the review, it kind of reads almost like a suspense thriller in the sense that as you're reading the book, you begin to realize there are crimes that have occurred here in the lives of these women. And there are perpetrators to be thought about. And there is a way in which, as we read the book, we start connecting things in the poems in a way that is very similar to what we would do if we were reading a murder mystery. Did you think, as you were writing the book, that you were doing some of the things like foreshadowing and laying clues that a mystery writer would do?
I think I did think about it in the sense of, you know, more like what the poet relies on is there's so much that's unsaid and unstated. That's part of what I love about poetry. You have what's in front of you and, you know, what is not there? What is the silence? So that was very much in my mind as I saw these one-sided accounts of women's lives and what's not being told to us, who gets to tell the story. So I did have it in my mind in that sense. And there became, you know, there were these clues of objects. Oh, you know, there's crochet involved and, you know, like how the needle might kind of carry through. So I think I did think of it, about it in that sense.
There's also certain pieces in the book. I'm not sure that I would even call them poems. Maybe they are poems. But they're sort of a version of admission documents, for example, that appear in the book. And it's like, you know, age, date, their appearance, you know, when they came in, various things. And I remember being struck in the one of these forms, and I believe it's in the form associated with the mother whose little girl has been lost. And it's just kind of thrown in without any sort of comment, and it never really kind of comes up elsewhere, I don't think, in the poems, that her right jaw is swollen at the time of her admission. And I thought to myself, wow,
yeah.
You know, she's telling us she's slipping something in here, and you can almost miss it if you don't read the book carefully. Is that the kind of thing where the reader is led to think about, well, my gosh, why was her jaw swollen?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's the part of what I love with these kind of experimental forms and fill in the blank, you know, almost like a Mad Lib. In the way we can drop a clue and also play around with a document, tells a story. It relies on who's taking down that information, and then how is that information used or totally ignored. Yeah, that all fascinates me.
You mentioned the little girl who was lost. She is said in the book to have died not just of drinking turpentine, but whiskey and turpentine,
yes.
Which sounds like a very strange combination of things. Maybe I'm overly imaginative about what the implications of that might be, but my mind goes to all kinds of very sinister places when I read a detail like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you intend that, I guess is my question.
I think what I had a vision for a project and it started like just falling together. So I think that what stood out to me, I pulled in and then these things just started lining up to make these characters' stories. But yes, it's like, you know, some things you can't make up, you know, it's like, who would have thought of that mixture and what is the backstory on that?
There's also in the book, we're given to consider the relationship of mental illness in women and, frankly, their anatomy and mm-hmm. their and in particular, the menstrual cycle. That's referred to on several occasions. The book is, to some extent, it feels to me, about the ways in which women were thought to be crazy because they were women. Can you speak to that?
Yes, and absolutely. And, you know, how they're thought to be crazy based on their body and, you know, what may be something that men who were very much in power, what they could not understand, you know, like they or didn't have themselves. So that kind of becomes a tool to silence the women, focus everything about their identity on this one part of who they are and on their bodies. Yeah, that's very much at play in all of my work is thinking about healthcare and where, you know, that involves power. And again, who gets to decide?
I want to thank you for being with us today on Eastern Standard. I also want to say as we close that your book, is published by Accents Publishing, which is a poetry publisher here in Lexington. And it's edited by Katerina Stoykova, who is a mutual friend of ours. And I just want to acknowledge them as the publisher of your book as well.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And I'm so grateful for the time and grateful to Accents Publishing for bringing this vision to an audience, to the world.
Well, thank you, Tina, and congratulations on the book.
Okay, thank you so much.
You can read Kevin Nance's review of Lock Her Up online at undermain.art. Tina Parker's book is available on the Accents Publishing website, accents-publishing.com. Coming up after the break, preparing for a return to work.
I think that's where we're headed. I think people back in a work environment, but less people per square foot.
And a stage and audience for those who make live music.
We need to support them more than ever. You know, this last year has been a great struggle for all individuals, but I think in particular for the artists.
The return of the Tall Sound Music Festival. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, join the Arts Council in celebrating Kentucky Writers' Day beginning 10 a.m. April 23rd on the Arts Council Facebook page. This virtual program, which celebrates Kentucky's literary traditions, will include the induction of novelist Crystal Wilkinson as Kentucky Poet Laureate for 2021 and 22. For more information, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. At 6 p.m. on April 23rd, Paul Sawyer Public Library in Frankfort will continue the Writers' Day celebration, hosting readings from former Poets Laureate in a virtual program on the library's Facebook page. Keywords, Paul Sawyer Public Library. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Bob Cole is president of Coleman Group Services, property management, brokerage, leasing, and consulting services relating to commercial real estate in Lexington and the surrounding area. When I last talked with Bob, that was back in June of last year, we were just then beginning to recognize the extent of COVID's impact on workplaces. And a lot has happened in the 10 months since then. So I've invited Bob back to tell us what he's seen and experienced. Thanks for joining us, Bob.
Glad to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Do you expect that this vaccination effort that's underway now, which is massive, is going to accelerate the return back to the workplace for many companies? Or going forward, are we looking at a new scenario that involves hybrid situations between remote work and people coming into the workplace?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. You know, we really weren't overbuilt going into this thing. You know, those days had passed. We actually had seen vacancy rates dipping to all-time lows, at least in my career, the last 30-plus years. And so, you know, that was a positive. So I think that we anticipate that there will not be as rash a reaction to the return. We think that we're going to see a large percentage of companies coming back to work. And what we're hearing from our tenants is that they were having difficulty in, you know, navigating how to, you know, manage that many people in so many different places. They've heard from their employees, and I'm getting this a lot, that, you know, they just didn't like being at home, that, you know, they wanted to be in a work environment with their coworkers and, you know, getting out of the house, so to speak, and actually having some adult time, getting away from children and dogs and all the nuances of trying to work from home. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think there's a clear path. What I really believe is that we're at an intersection, and we now have multiple roads that we can turn down. And I think each company is going to have to look at what best fits their mold. If I had to predict 12 months from now, and I think that's really what we're going to need to look at is kind of a 12-month window as to what the effects of this will be, because we don't know yet. You know, we're just now starting this, introduction back into the workplace. I think we'll experience the true impact in that 12 to 18 month range. My guess is that we're going to have somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 60 to 70% of of companies in Central Kentucky returning to the norm. And then there'll be that other, 25 to 30% of folks that will be, a combination, a hybrid, a work from home, potentially working from an office environment, or maybe, as we discussed, even working from a co-working environment where, they don't have a permanent lease to go to, but they have a more flexible leasing arrangement.
Are you hearing from any of your clients that they're having to reconfigure the structures of their office spaces to accommodate social distancing, that kind of thing?
It was almost like immediately the design work with the tenants that we were that were actively looking to expand or lease space, or even existing tenants, started engaging architects and designers. And where we had gone over the last, two decades, let's say, to a shrinking density of space, square footage per worker, which was getting down below 80 square feet per person because of the cubicle system. I recall when I started my career back in the early 80s that cubicles or what we called 80-inch walls were the norm, but there was more offices than the cubes or the 80-inch walls. And so what I think you're going to see now is kind of reversion back to where there are more independent offices, more independent call spaces where someone can go and work on assignments in an office not that may not be theirs, that they share with someone, but that they're making phone calls on, conferencing space, things of that nature. And if they are still utilizing a cubicle system, what we've seen is the divider separations, just like you would see at a restaurant. And then we had companies who, because of the need to immediately be continuing to work, what they did was they did social distancing in their work footprints. They 6-foot division between employees, which meant that they could not have as many employees working at any given time. And that's going to be interesting in the play out of this, where the density, in my opinion, will start to go back to probably what I would classify as normal square footage range. Wouldn't surprise me to see, more in the 150 to 200 square foot in the distant future. That may be too far a stretch, but I think that's where we're headed. I think that people back in a work environment, but less people per square foot.
How important is it that office managers, the businesses that are office-based, that they pay attention to this? And I'm wondering, if they don't make these changes, are they risking having their offices become obsolete?
The interesting part from what we're hearing is that, employees are sensitive to coming back to a work environment that is safe. They want to make sure that if they're being asked to work in an environment with other folks, that there are protocols and procedures in place, that they know that they can feel comfortable coming to work. It's one thing to want to come to work. It's another thing to feel safe coming to work. And I think that's really the storyline behind all of this pandemic, is that the employer, I think now, although they valued employees, now they truly value those employees, because it's super important to see that if you have a talented employee that you want to retain, that just salary and recognition isn't the only the gold stars to provide them with. They also want a safe environment from pandemic and other sources.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked back in June, Bob, we speculated, we worried about the potential for a long-term exodus from the downtown business districts of our communities out to the suburbs. Have you seen that happen?
So far, we have not seen the level of relocation that we were prognosticating. Mm-hmm. But again, I want to fall back on, it's early in the curve. It's early in the process. We may still see some of that. Remember now that most leases are longer term leases. So a lot of these tenants have leases that are still lease obligations to their landlords that may go out 1, 2, 3, and in some instances, 5 years or longer. So even though they may have the desire to relocate that, there may be a financial constraint because of a lease obligation before they can do so. Now, having said that, what we are seeing, which I think flows with your question, and that is that we are seeing companies start to terminate their leases. Leases that are coming up, they've not been what I would call large occupiers, but we're seeing a lot of this, which has been the life and the breadth of our business, is the 2,000 and 3,000 square foot footprints. You know, those, you know, 6, 7, and 8 employee offices. They, in some instances, have said, yeah, you know, we're not going to renew that lease. We're terminating that lease because our footprint is such that we can work our people from home. What we haven't seen are the 8,000 and 10,000 square foot footprints with service companies saying, you know, I'm going to shelter 100 folks in a work from home environment. And we're getting rid of our space. We haven't seen that yet. We have seen some expansion. There have been those that are looking at, you know, the glass half full and are looking at opportunities to negotiate leases at a time which it is advantageous for the businesses and tenants to do so, because they have what is probably a competitive leasing advantage over the owners of properties. And so having that opportunity, I see some companies looking to expand their footprint. So we just had a law firm in the suburbs that doubled their size. And so they saw this as an opportunity, not a negative.
Well, we've been talking about office spaces here, but what about other forms of commercial properties like retail, industrial, warehouses? What are you seeing in those areas?
On the retail side, you know, as we discussed in June, you know, there's really been a heavy burden on a lot of the malls and enclosed facilities, even some of the open air. No question that the pandemic accelerated the, if you will, the shrinking of the retail, you know, brick and mortar stores by 10 years. And I think that technology was already taking us there through the Amazon and delivery and so forth, the DoorDash and what folks are doing now. And so from a restaurant delivery standpoint. And so I think that all that did was accelerate probably the inevitable. We are seeing an emergence of the reusing of retail space for functions other than what would be known as the typical retail use of hair salons and clothing and so forth. There's starting to be medical practices and in instances, even storage spaces or distribution spaces. Mm-hmm. So I think of all the sectors that we'll talk about, I think retail without question has been hit the hardest and has felt the pain. I think there's more pain to come in that sector. Industrial, warehouse space, flex office space is very desirable. Warehouse space is at an all-time premium for the reasons that we just talked about in retail. You know, companies now, more and more companies are selling their products online, and you've got to be able to get that product to a distribution hub, which probably is broken down to a delivery hub that's going to bring it to your house. And so so industrial's hot. The investment sector altogether, as amazing as it is, there is a ton of equity on the sidelines. People aggressively and actively trying to buy investment-grade real estate, income-producing real estate.
Well, Bob, we noted last summer when we talked that this pandemic has hit us out of the blue. It didn't come with an instruction manual, for sure. So it's been a learning experience for everybody. And I'm wondering, what important things have you learned so far?
From a property management standpoint, several of the takeaways that we have are that we're definitely looking at our properties now from a service side. You know, before, you know, these were our tenants. Well, they're not our tenants anymore, although I've used that term a lot. The fact is they're our customers. You know, we need to take a page book from the hotels, and we need to start treating those folks that are occupiers in our office space as customers. And I think that's a big takeaway. You realize the value of those businesses to your bottom line, and we need to start treating them as such. With respect to the pandemic, what the pandemic did is it basically said, okay, you know, God willing, this may be the last one, but it probably won't be. And so in the event of another calamity like this, what can we do to ensure that we're prepared for the next one? And so some things that have been going on, kind of three areas that are really getting a lot of focus. You read about it in every article, and every person like myself that does a podcast or talks about it says, you know, air quality. And, you know, we're doing that ourselves. You know, we have a building downtown, a large asset that they invested in the ultraviolet light and the air handlers to protect the HVAC systems, you know, which kills germs and so forth. And so which produces a better air quality, you know, coming into the actual physical space. The janitorial, we're working and following closely the International Facilities Management Association, IFMA, and what the new protocol will be for janitorial cleaning. We're seeing a lot of owners like ourselves that are looking at high-touch, high-traffic areas like restrooms using germ-resistant paint. Sherwin-Williams has an excellent product that they're using for those type of protection matters. We're seeing a lot of folks looking into the touchless elevators. You know, you've probably seen some examples where new architecture and technology allows for you to get on an elevator and actually use your foot to, you know, push up or down and what floor you want to get off on. And so not having to actually push a button that's going to be pushed by 100 other people that day. Sanitizers are not going away anytime soon. So those are areas that I think from a office standpoint, what we're starting to see. Me, like everyone else, I'd like to see the mask wearing go on after the pandemic. I think that, you know, me and a lot of the folks that I talk to, you know, we'll be wearing a mask after this is long and gone, just thinking about maybe it'll keep me from getting a cold in the spring and the fall and so forth. So those are some of the takeaways I think that the pandemic has empowered us to look into.
Well, it's also interesting. Bob Cole is president of Coleman Group Services in Lexington, and we thank you for this update, Bob.
Thank you, Tom. Hopefully we'll do it again in 12 months and we'll see what else has changed.
We'll do that.
Thank you, sir.
Who's ready for small batch, everybody? Yeah. Come on now. You got great talent here in the great city of Lexington, Kentucky, so come on back. We doing Ralph's about, yeah. Come on.
As the pandemic took hold, one early and for many of us devastating casualty was live music. Venues and festivals canceled their events, and it's been unclear when they might be able to restart. A few went fully virtual using streaming services, but still, it wasn't the same. How could it be? Well, now people are getting their vaccinations, and at least one annual Lexington festival is preparing to pick up where it left off. Joining me is Chris Smith, organizer of the Tall Sound Music Festival. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Chris.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
And first, I'm sure you get this a lot. Will you explain for anybody who's not yet aware how you came up with that name, Tall Sound?
Well, it is a funny name, but it's a great festival. And for those that do not know, it is actually an anagram for the Southland Drive.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's T-A-H-L, Sound, S-O-U-N-D.
You've got it.
All right. So what led to the initial idea of Tall Sound? What were those first conversations like?
Well, it's comprised of four of us, friends and coworkers that came up with the concept a number of years ago. And through conversations and planning, it kind of developed, I mean, over the course of years into what it became, you know, the music festival. We wanted to celebrate and elevate and recognize the talent that was inherent on Southland Drive and in the city of Lexington. And the music festival on Southland Drive seemed like the best vehicle to arrive at that place.
Okay, and going back to that catchphrase, strange name, great festival, what makes this great this year?
Well, adaptability, I believe, in these current times.
Uh-huh.
It has always been important to us to focus on local artists and local talents. And particularly in these times, we need to support them more than ever. You know, this last year has been a great struggle for all individuals, but I think in particular for the artists. And so this year, we're looking forward to showcasing a number of local artists from all the communities that are represented here in Lexington. We're even kicking off our first event, actually, in April with a Latin night.
So, Chris, when is the first concert this summer?
We're looking at Sunday, April 25th. And then from there, it'll be the fourth Sunday of every month through September.
Okay. Most of the folks involved in the organization are also active musicians. And so I'm just wondering, how does a life in the creative arts inform what you do, inform the daily work of running a festival?
You know, in years past, it's been a lot about the interpersonal communication with other artists and playing shows and going out to shows and supporting the arts here at Lexington. And, you know, as that's been difficult over this last year, it's just been maintaining those relationships that we've developed over the past decade of being at shows and planning events. And in particular, in the last number of years, we've done exit surveys with even our participants, whether it be the musicians or those attending the festival, to try and, you know, narrow down and find the needs of the community. And I think this year it's pretty obvious what the needs of the community are, which is just family-oriented entertainment and an outlet for local artists and musicians to share their work.
Is the festival based on a certain set of values?
Our values are specifically to be a family-oriented festival that celebrates, elevates, and recognizes our local talent here in the city of Lexington, and to make it accessible and available to people of all walks of life.
So you're planning the 2021 season now, and I'm wondering, in what ways have you figured out how to do this in a COVID world? We're not out of the woods pandemic-wise yet. We're maybe getting there, but we're not there yet. How'd you do that?
You're absolutely right. And honestly, it came with a lot of deliberation and a lot of planning over the last year. In 2020, we chose to do two socially distanced events in the fall, just to sort of practice and lay out a plan for how things could work moving forward. So those two events we actually did in a parking lot there on Southland Drive in the Critchfield Meats parking lot. And it gave us an opportunity to kind of test a theory and just to see how the community would respond to it and get feedback from the community to see what their needs were. And honestly, through that effort, we learned so much and were able to adapt moving forward, understanding that social distancing is perhaps the most important right now. But right next to that is just providing entertainment that is accessible to family regardless of their socioeconomic status.
Are any reservations necessary, or would this be a reserved seat, something else?
What we determined last year, and we've always had the desire to lead Tall Sound towards being a free event. So due to the restrictions of the COVID world and the pandemic world, we do require a reservation, but it is a donation-based only, as we want to make it accessible to all folks. And so if they go to tallsound.com, you can make reservations up front. It's going to be a little bit limited. We have 40 spots available as we're trying to make do with the resources we have and the space that we have. And we want to use this first couple events to really feel out what the needs of the community are and what the response is, and be able to maybe develop it over the rest of the summer into something that is maybe a little bit larger as regulations and really the good interest of the people allows.
What's the alcohol policy?
We have a zero alcohol policy that can come in with you. The coolers are welcome. Please bring food, snacks, hang out with your family. West 6 will be there providing beer for you. But other than that, we just encourage people to bring what they need to be comfortable and have a good time with their family.
And so this is not a single weekend of concerts. It's spread out over the summer months. Is that right?
Yes, Tom. You know, this year we have decided to go with what we call a series, our summer series, as opposed to the two-day weekend multiple stage event. Considering the circumstances, we feel that this meets the needs of the community and also allows an opportunity for many different folks to see many different things over the course of the year.
We would be really remiss if we didn't talk about this. What kinds of music will we hear and see?
Fortunately, we have a vast and diverse community of musicians here in Lexington, and we want to recognize that. So you will see all sorts of music, from the first night being that Latin night. We're going to focus on that community and the arts therein. We always have a warm selection of Americana, bluegrass, but we'll also do some indie nights throughout the year, as well as focus on hopefully some interesting pieces coming out of the UK fine arts. Over the years, we've had a smattering of musicians that have come out of the ethnomusicology program, the Imbura program, the UK Gamelan Ensemble. So we're really hoping to continue those relationships and provide people with just an unusual night of music and things that they wouldn't otherwise see or hear.
Well, you know, you'll probably agree with this. I can't remember a time in my life when more people have been so pent up as as we find ourselves now. And there's this anxiousness about that. Of course, we got to be careful still, but it's a relief to hear, to even talk about this, about the possibility of it.
We absolutely agree with you on that. I know throughout the year, we have talked to a number of our musicians, friends, and other artists, and you know, it's been a lot of hurry up and wait. And, you know, we want to do what is best and what is responsible for our community. And we're just excited that we're at the point where we can even be talking about this. And we're going to take it slow and steady with safety as the main focus. But we're really excited about the opportunities this year has for us.
Well, Chris, where can people go online to learn more?
Well, tallsound.com, TALSOUND.com. It has all of the information they need for our upcoming events and a little bit of history, some photos and videos from the past to kind of see where we come from and, you know, help us develop where we're going.
That's Chris Smith. He's organizer of the Tall Sound Music Festival in the Southland neighborhood of Lexington, restarting for a summer 2021 season. Thanks and good luck, Chris.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
We seem to be beginning to emerge from COVID hibernation, and waiting for us to experience is all the art that's been created in this past very strange year. One new piece is appearing in a place where art can be a source of comfort, even healing. A work by stained glass sculptor Dan Neil Barnes is being unveiled in the atrium of the new Lexington headquarters of Bluegrass Care Navigators.
This sculpture will be a three-dimensional fused glass and metal sculpture suspended from the ceiling in the new atrium. It will have two major components, a 4-inch diameter aluminum bent pipe bent into a large giant squiggle with a spiral at the end that will be 23 feet long.
That structure supports more than 80 pieces of glass that will diffuse and amplify light.
I want the viewer to be taken to a place of calm, a place of peace, maybe even a place of wonder. But hopefully when they're sitting there viewing this piece, they can escape from the day's troubles and worries.
So light at the end of a long, dark tunnel?
For me, it's a sign of better days to come. I think it's on the horizon. I think the economy is on its way back. And for me, this is a sign of that.
Barnes' sculpture was made possible by Bluegrass Care Navigators, BB&T Bank, and LexArts. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, our producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, and Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Would you like to suggest an interview or a topic? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.